the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Rock historian Dave Thompson is my guest. He's written a zillion books on music and popular culture, and his newest one is Hearts of Darkness, James Taylor, Jackson Browne, Cat Stevens, and the Unlikely Rise of the Singer-Songwriter. Dave Thompson, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, thanks for having me.
A 40-year-old friend of mine laments what he calls the tyranny of classic rock. He says his generation's music has been forced into the shadows by the persistence of the sounds of the 60s and the 70s. And I think, you know, to a certain degree, it's completely true. Yet that period of music that you cover in your new book, Hearts of Darkness, it was a seminal era in music. You cover the years, I think, 67 to 75. And there was an amazing amount of great music created then.
Actually, it's a little tighter than that. The book is more sort of 66 through 72.
Okay.
And then a little bit of bleed over on either side. But, yeah, I mean, you're right. That, like it or not, and I'm in two minds, I mean, that period is, well, it's called classic rock for a reason.
Yeah.
Because they just hit us over the head with it constantly. It's like you can't turn around without Bachman Turner Overdrive lurking in the shadows.
Yeah. But the three people that you chose to focus on it in your book, and I loved the book. It was really a great read and terrific. But now I want you to sort of engage in an argument with me about it. Because it seems to me that those three, and they were great for that period that you write about, but all three of them, to me, they kind of represent a sort of an end of that amazingly creative period. I mean, when you think back in the 1960s, how much great music was made in just a short time. The Beatles made all their music in 8 years, and during those 8 years, the Stones and the Kinks and the Zombies and the Birds
and the
Beach Boys.
And
yeah, so, and the Jefferson Airplane and all that stuff all happened all at once. But when you think about those three, Cat Stevens particularly, and James Taylor and Jackson Browne, they had a creative period. And then all three of them really did almost nothing afterwards.
All three of them essentially destroyed the 60s, I think is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I agree. I mean, much as I like those three, I would not say, I mean, musically they were a cul-de-sac. There was nowhere you could go making music that selfishly. And, I mean, what I wanted to show in the book was how we got to a place where people were praised for doing that, and how the artists themselves suddenly realized, oh, my God, what are we doing here, and swerved out of it. With Cat, I think Cat did it the most dramatically.
He just dropped out completely, right?
Well, he made, you know, that run of, you know, lovely little records that every college dorm room echoed to for years, Peace Train and Wild World and all that. I mean, my wife was, she was at college at the end of the 80s, and they were still playing Peace Train and Wild World. but then, he came out with Foreigner, which was just such a bizarre record for anybody to have made, let alone somebody like Cat Stevens.
Yeah.
James Taylor wasn't quite as sort of aggressively throwing off the past, but he did so. And Jackson was sort of the joker in the pack in that he should never really have been lumped in with that movement, but he was through timing.
Well, it was interesting with Jackson. Let's talk about him for a minute. You know, when you first listened to him, when you first heard the Nina demos that you mentioned in the book, those first recordings that he made in 1967, 66, whatever year it was.
Yeah.
You can't even tell that's Jackson Browne. That doesn't even sound like Jackson Browne.
No. No, he's just sort of another very earnest, teenaged singer-songwriter.
He didn't have that quality of his voice that we came to love.
I've been out walking. I don't do too much talking these days. These days I seem to think a lot about the things that I forgot to do. and all the times I had the chance to. I stopped my rambling, I don't do too much gambling these days. These days, these days I seem to think about how all the changes came about my way. And I wonder if I'll see another highway. And I had a lover, I don't think I'll risk another these days. These days. And if I seem to be afraid to live the life that I have made in song, well, it's just 'cause I've been losing so long. Well, I'll stop my dreaming, I don't do too much scheming these days, these days I'll sit on cornerstones and count the time in quarter tones to ten. Please don't confront me with my failure. I had not forgotten them.
I mean, Jackson was funny in that, I mean, he was writing like the most astounding songs for his age. You know, when you think he was like 17 when he wrote These Days, you know, really he should have been 40.
Yeah.
It's like Jagger and Richards writing As Tears Go By. I mean, two kids their age had no business writing that song. So I mean, he was a great songwriter, but he was not a great Jackson Browne songwriter.
Well, you know, I saw him, and I'm a fan. I love Jackson Browne. I think he's great. And I saw him when The Holdout came out, and I think that was maybe 1980.
Yeah.
That he was playing. He played here at the Oakland Coliseum, and he really filled that place. Not just physically filled it with the people who were there, but he put on a show that filled the hall. And now I doubt he can fill, you know, an auditorium.
Yeah, I know he still tours around. I mean, I must admit, I've sort of lost interest in him.
Well, he plays his old stuff, you know, pretty
much.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, have The Pretender from start to finish. I love that album.
That's great. And, you know, that's interesting because he had that period where he, just like Cat Stevens, he had the first album, the second album, the Late for the Sky, then The Pretender, and then Running on Empty. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, yeah.
And James Taylor, he had the first album, which is kind of, you know, now when you listen to it, I think I like it better than I did when I heard it in 19.
You mean the Apple album?
Yeah.
The Apple album.
Yeah.
Yeah, it has weathered time a lot better. I still think the little musical interludes.
Those are annoying.
very annoying. But, I mean, I point out in the book that, you know, at the time, that's what people did. I mean, you know, the Beatles did that.
Right.
You know, you listen to side two of Abbey Road, it's basically the first James Taylor album.
You know, it's a little bit better.
A little, actually.
But, you know, if you take his version of, say, Caroline in My Mind, and then he recorded it again in 1975 or 76 for his Greatest Hits record. And if you put those two side by side, the earlier one is so much better.
Yes.
The 70s one is so slow and boring.
Well, I think with the early one, he was writing from his heart and, you know, and sang it while it was still fresh. By the 70s, you know, how many times can you be nostalgic for the same thing every night? I mean, re-recording it, you know, he wanted it for the Greatest Hits album, and Apple wouldn't let him have it. So, you know, he does it again, and you can almost hear that, oh, God, here we go again. You know,
well,
let's see if I can do something slightly different.
Well, Dave Thompson, you bring up an interesting point here. So you were saying how this music is kind of a musical cul-de-sac, and where do you go from here? But let's look at some of their contemporaries. I mean, the thing that's annoying to me about James Taylor is that he made this beautiful he made this beautiful sound, and then he basically duplicated that sound over and over and over, and continues to do it today.
Yep.
Whereas, say, Neil Young, if you liked this album, there's no telling that you'll like the next album, because each album is a completely different experiment in the sound of Neil Young. Or you say, where do you go from here? Where Joni Mitchell, you know, when she came to that same sort of stopping period, she moved on to some other new sound with, you know, her best records, Hejira and Hissing of Summer Lawns.
And Elton John, the same. I mean, he was lumped into that bag and jumped out of it very, very quickly. I wonder, with all three of those, if there was a degree of... You know, it's like David Bowie, you know, who was so desperate to have a hit that it wouldn't have mattered what was popular. He went for it and did it very convincingly. And finally, with glam rock, you know, he took off. And I wonder with, you know, Elton... Joni to a lesser extent, and Neil Young out of sheer bloody-mindedness. I wonder if they were, oh, I can do this singer-songwriter stuff. Mm. And so they did it. But really their interests lay elsewhere, and I think they proved that afterwards. You know, Elton rocked before he went solo. He rocked once he started having hits.
Oh, but Joni Mitchell was really one of the pioneers in the singer-songwriter, even though she's a girl. But, you know, she's... She's really one of the pioneers of the whole singer-songwriter movement, and one of the people who, you know, was singing about stuff that was happening to her. Or Paul Simon, for that matter.
Well, Paul Simon's different simply because he'd been around for so long. And I think by the time the singer-songwriter thing took off and, you know, Simon and Garfunkel broke up and he went off on his own, he already knew what he was doing. He was, you know, he's a craftsman. He could write a song about the siding on your house. and you'd buy it. Yeah, it's kind of, you know, the Paul McCartney syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Joni, I think she was a singer-songwriter by default because there was nowhere else to put her. If she'd had sort of slightly stripped back instrumentation, she could have been Leonard Cohen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I would never blame Joni Mitchell for the singer-songwriter movement.
And I like the way you put it, blame. So, you know, and there was a gajillion of them, and some of, I mean, there was some really great music that came out of that era.
Yeah, Laura Nero.
Sure.
You know, but again, you know, she was a songwriter first, and I think...
Well, she had a lot of soul that the other singer-songwriters don't really have.
Yeah. I mean, that album that she did with LaBelle was just amazing.
Yeah.
So again, there were the people who were writing songs that could be fit into that genre, and they were. And then there was the people, I think, who set out to create the genre. And I think James Taylor and Peter Asher together.
Yeah, well, Peter Asher is definitely a player in your story. And
yeah.
The listeners may remember him as a record producer, but probably more likely remember him as half of Peter and Gordon.
Peter and Gordon, yeah.
Had those great
hit records. Very underrated producer. I mean, the stuff he did with Linda Ronstadt in particular. I mean, that sort of defined great swathes of the 70s.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I think he did James Taylor better with Linda Ronstadt than he did with James Taylor. I mean, the sound on Your Heart Like a Wheel, I think, is what James Taylor would have died for. You know, in her version of You Can Close Your Eyes... It just sort of, it makes his sound like a demo.
Well, I guess one interesting thing about Linda Ronstadt is that she was not a songwriter, so she could have a lot of craftspeople writing great songs, whereas James Taylor had gotten, except for the song he recorded by Carole King, he pretty much got himself locked into being a singer-songwriter, so that by the time he got to, and I think you point this out in the book, by the time he got to One Man Dog or Walking Man or... You know, he had pretty much run out of songs.
Yes. And I mean, that is the other danger. If you're going to really lock yourself into a genre, you know, which is why Neil Young has survived, you know, he could probably not have written another Harvest. for a few years, but you know, he could certainly write other stuff. And you do get the feeling he just didn't care. It's like, okay, I've done that, now I'm going to do this. And it became a little bit of a cliche, I think, you know, by the 80s.
Well, he was sued by his... He was sued by David Geffen for not sounding like Neil Young.
Yeah, I mean, that is just so funny. Yeah, so, I mean, I guess it wasn't at the time for Neil, but, you know, it's like, you listen back to the 70s albums, and he didn't really sound like Neil Young then.
No. He never sounded like Neil Young.
Yeah, On the Beach was certainly not Harvest.
Well, it's interesting, because I think you look at... Harvest was his most successful album, and he followed it with his least successful album, which was Time Fades Away.
Yes. The album that nobody has.
Yeah. I have
it. I like that one. Yeah, I like that one. I love the Journey Through the Past soundtrack as well.
That's a great record.
Yeah.
That has Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's greatest recording on there, I think, this beautiful version of Find the Cost of Freedom. Into Ohio. It's really great.
Yes. Yeah, and it's like, I can't hear either without wondering where the other one is.
Yeah, me too, because of that record, which has never been on CD as far as I know, I don't think.
No, I think there are little bits of it are on that Archives box set.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, the sidelong version of Words.
Now, for you personally, this really isn't the era of music that you are... Well, you've never written about it so much before. You've always written about the punk era or the post-punk era.
Or the post-British invasion era.
Yeah, because you've written about Bowie. You've written a couple of books about Bowie, right?
Yeah, I've written about Cream, Jeff Beck.
Cream. Well, that's 60s, right?
Being a Brit, American music is very much a foreign country. Yeah, they do things differently over there, those Yanks. But I've been here 20 years, so I figured it was about time. No, I mean, I've not steered clear of this period. It's just that there's always been other things to do. But this has been an idea that had been sort of floats. I think simply because I found the singer-songwriter movement so inexplicable was a large part of it. It's like, for the life of me, I could not figure out how that music became so popular. And it was an American phenomenon. In England, I mean, those people all had hits, and of course Cat was one of ours anyway. But it's like they existed as part of everything else that was happening. There wasn't... You didn't sort of sit down and say, right, it's singer-songwriter time. You know, James Taylor came along while we were still listening to blues rock and Black Sabbath and things.
Right. So, I mean, there... I think James Taylor's album and Led Zeppelin's first album come out pretty much the same time. So,
yes.
So why do you think, you know, I mean, there were 16-year-old boys listening to Led Zeppelin, but there was a lot of people listening to James Taylor and Jackson Browne.
I think it was 26-year-old boys listening to James Taylor.
Uh-huh.
It was an older demographic that they were aiming for. I think it was that generation that grew up with the rock and roll in the 50s, you know, kind of liked the Beatles, but they were getting older, they were settling down, they wanted to listen to new music still, but they didn't want this long-haired, loud hippie noise. You know, they wanted music that sort of related to your life when you're too old to be drafted.
Well, I guess, you know, for pop songs, and I guess this really does fall into the category of pop songs, you know, for ages... Those pop songs were written as love songs to 10-year-old girls.
Yeah.
And so now there's an older generation that's ready for something else.
Yeah. They wanted songs about, you know, life as it is lived, not as you think it should be. And we can't all run around with berets and camouflage trousers being urban gorillas when you're in your 30s with two kids and a mortgage. So you sit down and listen to, you know, James Taylor, Cat Stevens... of wonderful, it relates to your life. And I think that was what their magic was. They found an audience that had been almost sidelined by the music industry in general.
Well, I was looking back as I was reading your book, thinking about the roots of this era, and obviously the folk music era is the core root of it.
Yeah.
And there were some singers who, you know, like John Denver springs to mind as a very successful performer who started as a folk singer, kind of a clone of Tom Paxton.
Yeah. But, I mean, he was smart because he moved into country,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, is a world unto itself. I don't really consider him to be in this bag, but someone like Tom Rush,
uh-huh.
who has also had his sort of country moments. But, I mean, his first two solo albums in particular, you know, were very much, you know, on one hand, they were sort of a poor man's Dylan. But on the other, you could see here is somebody who's got an eye on an older audience. And, of course, he was the one who recorded, James Taylor, Jackson Browne, and Joni Mitchell songs all on the same album.
They're the first to record a lot of them, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because there's a bunch of people there that you mentioned. Eric Anderson, he had been a folk singer and Thirsty Boots
yeah.
and all. And then he really kind of became a singer-songwriter type for a while in the 70s.
Eric Anderson was great and like just completely forgotten now.
Yeah.
In fact, a lot of people on that Vanguard label, you know, during the 60s, I mean, Vanguard could very much be sort of put into this whole bag. Because Joan Byers started right. to move into this direction as well.
Right. I think her song, Diamonds and Rust, is
yeah.
the one that fits right in here.
Yeah. And, you know, we always think of Joan Byers as, you know, largely doing covers, usually Dylan ones.
Right.
But, you know, she was writing a lot of stuff. And, of course, Diamonds and Rust, I mean, if she'd never written another song, that would have assured her immortality.
It's a good one.
Yeah. To the point where other people cover it, and you just think, what are you thinking?
You talked to a couple of, I don't know if you actually spoke to them, but that you mention or you quote a couple of people who have been guests here on the show from that era and from the early Jackson Browne years. Steve Noonan, who's been a guest on the show, and also Pamela Polan, who was recently on the show. Did you interview them?
No, I didn't. Steve Noonan didn't return any of my phone calls. It was so frustrating.
Yeah, well, his their experiences are pretty interesting because, you know, they were all on the same kind of trajectory, Tim Buckley also.
Yeah. And I mean, that Steve Noonan album is, I mean, I was so glad when it got reissued.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it was an album that really should have been paid attention to at the time.
That song, Leaning Back and Laughing, is really a wonderful song.
Yeah. You know, and instead he's just become sort of a footnote in the Jackson Browne story.
I'm sure he hates that.
Oh, that's probably why he didn't return my call.
That could be. And Pamela Poland, her earlier music that she recorded with her group, those are available on websites.
Yes.
And it's nice to hear that music again.
Yeah, I mean, there were so many people who I guess I could have focused on in the book.
Well, everybody got a mention. It seems like you've mentioned almost everybody, but you didn't. you didn't mention your own countryman, Ralph McTell. Doesn't he sort of fit into this too?
I always think of him as sort of he was a folky and he stayed in folky.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like Ralph McTell a lot, but he just didn't seem to fit in. It was like, you know, sort of moving into the... Al Stewart is the other one, and he almost... I mean, he got a few mentions.
Right.
But Al Stewart's, you know, entire oeuvre, I think, from that period through most of the 70s, I mean, he was one of the ones who actually survived and kept making good records, and actually some of his better ones came later.
Yeah. We're talking with Dave Thompson, and he's a rock historian, popular culture historian. His newest book is called Hearts of Darkness, James Taylor, Jackson Browne, Cat Stevens, and the Unlikely Rise of the Singer-Songwriter. You've written so many books. Do you never go out of your house? You just sit at the computer constantly listening to music and writing?
Pretty much, yeah.
What are you working on now?
At the moment, I'm actually doing a book about Doctor Who, the TV series.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
What do you
have to say about Doctor Who? I guess we'll have to wait until our next show. Or?
That's it, isn't it? It's like, you know, there are so many Doctor Who books. I'm running it from the American angle, actually. Nobody has ever really talked about it you know, as it sort of it came to the US in the 70s and what it means to an American audience. So, I mean, that's been a lot of fun. It's given me an excuse to just sit there watching old episodes, you know, 18 hours a day. Yeah, it's like the cats are so sick of Daleks at this point.
And you recently wrote a book about erotic cinema.
Yes. Yeah, which is, again,
Black and White and Blue, I believe it's called, right?
Black and White and Blue, yes. That, I mean, that was just fascinating. Porn films from the 1910s, you know, you can't beat them.
How did you find them all?
Well, I mean, it was funny. Years ago, when I was living in Seattle, there was I was actually writing a book about John Travolta, and I was talking to like this old, little old lady who lived next door. And I was talking to her over the fence one day, and I mentioned it, and she just made this cryptic remark about, you know, well, some of us made films, dear, that, you know, nobody remembers. And it's like, that's weird. And just over a period of time talking to her, probably over like 6 months, finally came out that she had been making risque films in Seattle in the 1930s. So, and it's like, we ended up doing an interview about it, and it was just one of those things that sat around for years, and it's like, you know, I've got to be able to do something with this one day. And just, you know, every so often, you know, it's like I'd go onto the internet and just, you know, I'd Google, you know, porn films 1930s, and started to find that there were.
Oh.
You know, there was like this huge...
Wait a minute, let me get this straight. You're saying there's porn on the internet?
Would you believe it?
It's stunning.
I mean, I was
You're going to have to look into this. Yeah,
I was shocked. And, of course, there was also that great movie, Inserts, with Jessica Harper, which, you know, was about a silent movie producer who fell on hard times when talkies came along. So he started making porn films and, you know, in the 1920s. And it's like I put those sort of two things together and I thought, you know, there's a book here. And just had such a great time. I was able to source films, some online, some from like collectors, and it'd be great. You know, the in-laws would, you know, call up and say, "Do you want to come to dinner?" And it's like, "I can't, I'm working," and I'd be sitting in the basement watching porn films. But the funniest thing was, it's like after the first sort of half an hour, you're not actually looking at the people, you're looking at the furniture, trying to figure out when the film was made.
When was this made?
You know, call the wife down and say, "Okay, you see that bureau behind them? When would you say that's from?" it was a great book. It was so much fun to do.
Well, I hope when your Doctor Who book comes out, you'll come back and chat with us some more.
Oh, I hope so. That would be great.
This book is called Hearts of Darkness, James Taylor, Jackson Browne, Cat Stevens, and the Unlikely Rise of the Singer-Songwriter, and the author, Dave Thompson. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. Talk to you soon.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show and come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook or iTunes. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. I want to thank my guest, Dave Thompson. His newest book, Hearts of Darkness, James Taylor, Jackson Browne, Cat Stevens, and the Unlikely Rise of the Singer-Songwriter. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.